Two drinks. I'll call it named Christy Ellis. You know what's so cool about that is we read that at my home group. And I love that because we read it on Sunday morning. My home group's at 9:30 on Sunday mornings and we read that. So I was like, oh, that was just like washed right over me. Beautiful. Hey, everybody. I am an alcoholic named Christy Ellis. My sobriety date is April 12th, 1988. I have a tour guide. That's what I call sponsors. I get to be one as well. And my home group is the Awakening Troop. As I said, open speaker meeting on Sunday mornings. We're hybrid. You're hybrid. Hey, peeps. Anyway, it's great to be with you beautiful people. Happy, happy Sunday. I can't think of anywhere I'd rather be than with you beautiful people. Some of you I know, some of you I sort of know, and some of you I don't know. But fact of the matter is, we know 75% about each other before we even know each other's names. So it's great to see you guys. Thank you for having me. It's always, I love it up here. It's such a beautiful ride. And I'm grateful that it's the light is what it is now, because if it were daylight saving times, I wouldn't get to enjoy all that beautiful scenery and the trees and all that good stuff. Anyway, what time do I start? That's an important stop. What? 7, whenever you're done. Okay. Okay. I just like to be a respecter of the clock. And so I can do that. Well, I have, it's just my turn to talk tonight. I know y'all have people each week, and I believe we take turns in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether it be speaking, doing any kind of service, anything we do, we just take turns. That's why I love our rotation that we practice and everything we do, you know, so everybody gets to do it. The highest you get here sober, it's a level playing field, you know, nobody's up here. It's we all do this thing shoulder to shoulder, and we're all here for the same reason. Most of us are anyway. And that's, we want to live. I don't know about you, but I want to live because I was dying from a disease called alcoholism. And I do believe in identification. That's what hooked me when I got here, is, you know, hearing somebody describe how I was feeling inside and I didn't even know who they were, you know, that got my attention. And I believe that needs to be at every meeting. And so I will tell about that, because I can tell you all the good stuff that's happening in my life. And you're going to go, so what, big deal, who cares? How about, you know, how, let's connect in as a drunk first, and then we can talk about the other. And so grateful to be here. Like I said, I'm always grateful to be anywhere with my people, because I am my best with you guys, you know, and I met you over 36 years ago. I got sober when I was 30. I'm 67 years old. I am married for almost 24 years, have 9 grandchildren, 6 kids between the two of us, and 4 dogs. So I got a very full life just in that way. But they're all gifts. It's all gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. Results of, is what I should say, of the actions that I've taken since I've gotten here. Now, these, my kids were not the results of that, but the relationship I have with them is, and you know, the way the marriage is and the life that we live is. And so, and I always like to, you know, say that, because there's that hope, you know, and I heard people talk about that too. And that's why I'm going to describe, you know, how it was for me before I got sober, how I got sober, and then how it's been like, what it's been like for me since I've been sober. I'm the oldest of 4 children. I live in North Chesterfield, Virginia, which is right a suburb outside of Richmond. My parents were young when they had me. They were 19 and 20. You know, back in, I was born in 57. So back then, a lot of times folks got out, you know, married right out of high school, you know, and then they started having children. They had me when, pretty much right away, then a brother 3 years later, 9 years later, and 12 years later. So 3 brothers and a little spread. Yeah, last year seemed like there was a big break, and then 2 more brothers. But so I am the oldest of 4. I'm the only girl. And I was like, I just wanted all the attention, plain and simple. When that other brother came along, I was like, wait a minute, whoa, who's this baby? For 3 years now, it's been all about me. And my mom talks about it. It's fun. It's a fun. I think it's funny. She said when they brought him home, everybody's like making over him. And I'm like jumping up on the table and saying, first, me is going to sing. So I'm trying to get attention from the get-go. And that wasn't the last time I danced on tables, but that was a little different situation. So anyway, I had a really, I've got to say, I had a great childhood. I really did. I had a really good childhood. Gosh, we had everything we needed, almost everything we wanted. And a lot of that was because my mother grew up poor and my parents just determined to give us a really good life. They taught us a lot of really, you know, really a good way to be practical, you know, principled people. But there were great examples. But I looked at life differently, you know, then I always wanted, you know, everything had to be something like it had, you know, and my mom, it's funny, you learn a lot about yourself after you get sober and people tell you how you really were. And because I had this version of me, I thought the way it was. But she'd be like, Chrissy, with you, it was always the first time, the last time, the only time, your favorite time. It was like, you know, and it was like, yeah, everything had to be a big deal. It was first, best, most. That's the way I can describe, you know, the way I was. I want to be first. I want to have be the best. I want to have the most. And then I started adding words. I want the biggest. I want the longest. You know, I want the this. And so anything that's going to be, you know, grandiose, I wanted because I was very attached to outside things making me feel like I matter. You know, and people, what I was doing, if I had a lot of friends, if I had the most Barbies, if I had this. So, you know, that's the way I thought, even as a child, even though great childhood, Girl Scout, went to camp, you know, did all the, you know, a lot of playing outside. 60s was awesome time to grow up, and it was a lot of really fun. I mean, it really was, and I'm grateful for it. When I turned 12, we moved to a new neighborhood and met a whole bunch of new kids. And when I turned 13, my parents watched me just do a 180 right in front of them. And it's when I fell in love with peace, love, dove, rock and roll, all the earrings, the clothes, the bands, the boys, all that stuff, and all changed. And I gotta say, I've been a seeker really my whole life. And I hear that a lot from a lot of us, you know, always looking for something. And I mean, I read books like crazy and identified with the people in the books. And I'm a fantasy girl, I'm a pretend girl. I wanted to know. I used things like the magic eight ball and Ouija boards and for, you know, the little paper things you did in school to, you know, to figure out, you know, is he going to call me and shake that ball until it says yes? You know what I mean? And things like that. And, you know, it's so funny the things that will like, I was, and that's so outside me thinking I, you know, can conjure up what I want. But I did. I believed in God, went to church. I realized when I got sober, I never disbelieved in him, but it was a lot in my head. It's a lot what I knew in my head. It wasn't in my heart. And so I'm always seeking, trying to fill that God-shaped hole. I didn't like the way I felt. So I tried this, I tried that. And when I hit 13, like I said, I did the 180. And when I and learned how to smoke cigarettes in the girls' bathroom when I was 14. And I tell, you know, a lot, I say this a lot because I mean, I can still, it still feels like it was yesterday. And I'm gonna have my 50-year reunion next year. So that's a pretty long time ago. And but I still remember sitting in front of that mirror with my friends practicing blowing smoke rings and French inhaling. And it's so funny. I told that story recently, and this little young guy came up, he said, "What is French inhaling?" You know, does anybody in here know what it is? Yeah, of course. I guess it's a boomer thing. But anyway, but I can just remember that. And we had smoking areas at school. You could, you know, get a permission slip and smoke at school. And even if you didn't get the permission slip, you smoked at school. But you know, I was just very drawn to having fun. But like I said, I, you know, great, really great parents and a good life. I'm very grateful for it and will be forever because I know that's not everybody's experience. It and I guess I say it too is because a lot of times you'll hear, you know, folks, we can say, I know I can say, well, if I only had this or that, if I had that, I'd be okay. But that's not true. I had that. And it's like I'm an alcoholic. I look at life different. Alcoholism doesn't care. You know, it alcoholism is different. You know, I, you know, nothing's ever enough for me. You know, I want what you have, even though I got good stuff, you know, and it's that's just the way I thought. And so when I was 14, this girl asked me if I wanted to go up to Safeway International, which is in Carytown, if any of you are familiar with Richmond. And it used to be, it's Kroger now, but it was Safeway International. And she said, "We'll get somebody to buy us some alcohol." I was like, cool. Now I grew up in a home where my parents drank. They did Tom Collins and neighbor drinks, social drink, and all that stuff. But I wasn't worried about what they were doing. I'm thinking about myself. And so we got it, and I always do the disclaimer. She picked what we drank. It was Boone's Farm. Everybody's got a Boone's Farm story most times. Anyway, if you have one, there's a little club of people that have a Boone's Farm story. It's the only time I really ever drank Boone's Farm, but I always give her credit for that. But I didn't dance on tables like I did when I was three. But I didn't dance. I didn't pass out. I didn't do nothing major happened except it clicked off that I want more. Man, I want more. And more became my most favorite thing. And I'm now really seeking. I'm trying to find the people that are doing this thing. I want to drink. I want to have fun. A lot of alcohol enhancers were going on at that time, too. We all know that. So it's just that world that, you know, early 70s was actually a pretty safe time to grow up and party, you know. And I just found my people. And I started getting more involved with doing that on the weekends and getting in trouble and finding the guys and going to concerts, $5 to go see Alice Cooper hang himself on stage. I can remember in Coliseum, you could fill a big Tapestry pocketbook with two or three six packs of beer and then say a word. Nothing. Now you can't even, you gotta take a little clear pouch and that's about it, which I get it, things are different. But back then it was just like wide open, you know, party town. And I loved it. I loved every minute of it. In school, I really just mainly focused on what are we gonna do? Gonna go out and party and what new cute guys were at school, you know, and that's it, you know. And so by the time I hit my senior in high school, I had been getting in a lot of trouble and doing different things. And I'm forever grateful to my mom. She would let me go to these concerts and she would let me, you know, explore these different things. But I was getting in trouble a lot. And but so by the time I hit senior, I decided maybe I did want to go to college. And that's a kind of a, you know, I really didn't appreciate my principal coming up to me and telling me what a good job I was doing. I don't want anybody seeing me talk to the principal, but he even noticed because I'd been doing so terrible, you know. And so right now I realize that was a person that cared. You know, back then I'm like, ugh, don't talk to me. You know, I don't want anybody to think I know you, you know. And just like I used to like walk 10 feet behind my mother when I'd go shopping because I didn't want anybody to think that I had a mother. You know, yet when we get to the register, she's gonna pay for everything. So, you know, it's just funny how we think when we're young like that. But so I decided I didn't want to go to college. And I was really good at throwing my family in a tailspin about, you know, last minute stuff because I was just that way. And so I did pick some colleges that were partying schools. Radford College is where I ended up picking. That was the first year guys were there in 1975. And I knew that I just couldn't wait to get there. And it just looked like a big party. And that's what it was. Tech was 30 minutes away, so I knew that if we got bored at Bradford, we could run on over to Tech. And I wasn't even concerned about them. I go to school. My parents are, I say I went on my parents' scholarship because they paid my way, you know, and I took full advantage of that. I'm not even thinking about that. These are people that really gave me every opportunity in the world. You know, they get, I learned piano. I mean, I did all kinds of stuff, you know, took dancing, I did all this stuff, and I was, they exposed me to so many things. And it's just, and when I was about 13, I think it was 13, I was a camp counselor for underprivileged children. And I knew that I wanted to help people, even that young. I just want to help people. But the thing that happened is once I got caught up in alcohol in my teenage years, the boys and the booze is what I call it, all that I wanted to help people stuff went over here. And all I focused on is how can I feel better? Because I don't like how I'm feeling. If I'm not drinking, I feel irritable, I feel restless. I don't know what that is, discontented. So I'm always creating, you know, let's do this. And what do you mean you need to go to work tomorrow? Let's just stay up and all that kind of stuff because I didn't like the way I felt. And alcohol was a great answer for me for a long time. It took me a lot of places and took me through a lot of insanity. And so I went to Radford College. It lasted 6 months. Because if you don't go to class, they ask you to leave. And that's just it, plain and simple. I didn't go, you know, my feet hit the ground and I'm like, where's the student center? And let's get going with the partying. My drinking changed then. It seemed like every time I made a change that my drinking changed. That's when my blackout drinking started. And that's when I, you know, start, you know, I'm going across campus at 3 in the morning, you know, stumbling along and nothing happened, thank God, but stuff happens. You know, when I think about the, you know, alcohol, I just think I'm invincible, you know, and I'm just a walker in dangerous situations, not thinking anything's going to happen to me. So many times they found me, you know, laying passed out in front of my, you know, dorm, or I'm getting to know the security guys, my first, you know, name because they're going to keep letting me in my dorm all the time, or I'm waking up in dorms with people I don't know, don't even know what dorm it is, you know, all that insanity that, you know, happens in the blackouts. And then that whole thing of avoidance. I don't want to run into these people because I don't want to know what happened. I don't want anybody asking me, but somehow people do find you and they like to tell you anyway. And so that all that did was start creating, you know, loose ends inside of me. And I talk about loose ends because they started at 18. And when I got sober, I had a lot of loose ends. And it was like everything that eat me alive from the inside out, like a piranha. What are the loose ends? The thing, money I didn't pay back. Things I didn't go to, I said I was going to do. Anything I was responsible for that I didn't do, anything promises I made, anything I didn't finish, you know, created loose ends. And it made me feel bad about myself, but I didn't know that then. I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't worked steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went with a sponsor or gone through the big book. I wouldn't have known any of that. I wouldn't be able to put words to any of this. But what it's see in retrospect, and today, That can happen just as much if I don't take stuff. That's why, take care of things. And 10th step's beautiful for that. But anyway, so I'm creating all these loose ends, owing people money that, and then I'll leave college. And my mom had, she ran such a structured household. I said, I can't go back in that, not after I've had all my freedom and done what I want. And I just wasn't very considerate of guys, and it has nothing to do with you guys. That was me, that God-shaped hole stuff. Me thinking human power can relieve me of my alcoholism. I love the ABCs and how it works, because no human power can. Nothing can. Clothes can't, hair can't, job can't, guys can't, none of that can. But somehow I thought it could. And so I sometimes wasn't very nice. Sometimes I, would like somebody, it'd wear off after 3 months, and I'd say, you know what, that was just the wrong guy. I need to get another one. And it's really about me placing that, demand. The book, I think the 12 and 12 talks about putting demands on others, these, and they're unreasonable demands to make me happy. And me holding you responsible for how I'm feeling, and it happens so easily, and instead of like, of course, I'm not going to realize it. I'm in the throes of alcoholism, not, even at 18, 19 years old. So I come home, move in with a friend from school. It blows up after 6 weeks. Till I got sober, I thought it was all her fault. And then moved in with my cousin. I grew up in a family. My mom had a lot of brothers and sisters, and so it was a very fellowship family. So I'm very familiar with fellowshipping and getting together and things like that. And my cousin was a year older than me, and we were like best buds. Grew up, spending the night together all the time, and we just all the family said stuff. She was getting a divorce, and I saw an opportunity. For a minute, I was really felt bad for her, and then the next minute, I was like, "You don't need that guy, man. We can go out, we can have fun. You don't." And her marriage is falling apart, and I'm like, "Of course." There's something in it for me. And she lived across town, so my family wouldn't really see what I was doing. It's because my parents carried me on their car insurance, but I'd never tell you that because I wanted you to think I was Miss Independent. I got a job, and then, I'm living with her, and that's when my drinking changed again. And what happened then was I think people that have gotten sober maybe in the last 10 years, I don't know, I heard somebody say it. That's called pre-gaming. We just called it drinking shots before we went out, so we wouldn't drink so much. And doesn't matter, you just got drunk quicker and still drank a lot, because little did I know that when I took a drink, all bets are off. And I'm looking for more drinks. Even if I don't have money, somehow I found drinks. So I'm living with her, my drinking changes that way. I start getting to a place of Fanny's. I don't know if any of you ever went to Fanny's in Richmond. That was a bar there. I felt comfortable going in there by myself. And I started doing ridiculous things, like just, not to, just to be in a general way. Just I was just leaving with people and not knowing where I was going, and not where I was when I woke up, and not know where my car is, and just that kind of, and once again, making me feel bad about myself, creating more wreckage, hurting people, and just really, when I look back at the devastation, how we tear through people's lives, even at 19, I'm doing that. Because I'm placing that demands on everybody, and I never thought it was drinking. I never thought it was a drinking. I would never even consider it being the drinking. It was just wrong place, wrong time, wrong guy, wrong this, wrong that, but never the alcohol. And I like to tell the band story. Some people think it's funny, some don't, but the story, I always thought, like I dated a guy on a hockey team. Ooh, I thought it was something because I dated one of that French Canadian guy on the hockey team. Look at me. So that's that outside stuff trying to make me feel better about me. So I went, I got to know the band at Fanny's, and I'm like, yeah, y'all come on back to our house. And thank God nothing happened. But I wake up the next day and I got all these guys there with all these instruments. And then I got to pile them in this little teeny car that I have and drop them off at their hotel. I never think one word about, I shouldn't, I'm not drinking anymore. It's, I'm never bringing bands home anymore. That's it. That's all I get out of that. And so it's like, I'm not gonna, even, I didn't get sober till I was 30, almost 31. So you could think I'm 19 when I'm doing that. So what happened is I had great examples as parents and of marriage. I think I loved love, and I just wanted to be in love. And I'm a romantic at heart, and just very idealistic, and I believe the good in all. And I just, I'd fall in love with characters in books. And like I said, I'm very make believe, and that when I'm fantasy girl. And God has been giving me information my whole life, and I didn't pay attention to it until I got sober. And the way I equate that too in sobriety is to an informed group conscience, getting all the information and making a decision based on the facts. Well, I didn't do that before I got sober. I based it on what I want. And if the pic if it didn't fit the puzzle, I somehow I try to make it fit the puzzle. And so I liked Bad Boys. I knew I did. Long hair, no job, no license, smoking pot, figuring out the world. Man, that was my kind of guy. You know, and I don't know why, but it was. And well, I met this another bad boy. He used to go to school with me. They got kicked out. He was in the army, but I thought it was meant to be. This is one of those things. I mean, the love stuff talks about it. Don't, you know, and they're about, I can't word it correctly, but just like, well, his name was Chris and mine was Chrissy. And I thought that was meant to be. That's what it talks about. Don't be fooled by thinking things that sounds like it's, ooh. And I said, it's got to be meant to be. He's got to be the guy's same name, you know. So anyway, he was my drinking buddy. He was in the army. He went to Germany, asked me to marry him in the mail. Oh my God, the romantic in me came out. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to get married. Yay, we're finally going to get married. And okay, that's what I've been wanting. God shaped tool, fix, make me, you know, get in a relationship, have kids, have this white picket life, you know, all that that I'm thinking that's going to make me better. And so I moved back in with my parents, but I still partied my butt off. And I got a lot of information one night when we were getting ready to mail the invitations. And this is a big deal. His captain in Germany called me in Richmond, Virginia, and said, you may not want to marry him. He's in a lot of trouble. That's a lot of info. Now, today, if somebody told one of us sober that, we'd be like, yeah, you're right, man. I shouldn't, you know, maybe we would. I don't know. Depends on who it is and where you are in your sobriety, I guess. But anyway, so I'm like, you don't know him like I do, of course. You know how that goes. You know, even though he's treated all those women like that, he treats me different. And I understand him. So anyway, God love my mom. I mean, I'm the oldest. She was, you know, the only girl. She planned this beautiful wedding. She would have, was in a position to do that. And so they reordered the invitations and we got married. And I was 21 when I married him and had a daughter, Brooke at 22, son Justin at 23, son Jarrett at 25, and we split up when I was 26. They were 4, 3, and 1. And that marriage was, I didn't really know him, really. And it turned out that I'd married someone that I was violent, and I was exposed to a whole lot of things that I had never been exposed to in my life. I'd never been in a situation. My family wasn't like that. You know, I feel like all of a sudden I'm living in a TV show or something that I'd seen on TV. And I got scared. And alcohol was definitely a solution for me. I drank a lot. I did. And I didn't work after I had, after I had Justin, especially after Jarrett, because it was cheaper for me to stay home. He made a good living and we had bought a home and things just got really crazy. But alcohol became even more of a best friend for me, and smoking cigarettes, not eating hardly at all, and drinking. And that was it. And the thing is, I wanted to be a good mom. That's it. The whole thing is I love those kids like nobody's business. And I just wanted to be, I thought, you know, this was like a dream crashing. You know, I'm thinking when I get married to him, even though I didn't know him that well, I had this, you know, that fantasy in my own mind, delusion, which wasn't the truth. But I'm thinking that's what it's supposed to be, and it's not. And so I can remember before we split up, he'd be gone and I'd be watching the lights coming down the street to see if that's him. Is that him? I drove myself crazy like that. If you think about it, I was 25 years old, 26 years old. And you know, when it came to a head like that, I had my son Jared at 25, and then I turned 26 right after that. And the long and the short of it is we did split up, and which, you know, should have happened. I didn't, you know, and so I moved into an apartment. And you know, we sold the house, so it gave me money so I could get on my feet a little bit. And for a while, I did not work. I moved in the apartment, and God's always put people around me, these wonderful people. This family moved in next door, and they saw a girl in trouble. I had wonderful parents that were so supportive. I'm very fortunate that way. My family was very supportive, you know, and there, because you think about it, I mean, my parents were young. When they were in their early 40s when all this was going on, because they had me so young. Mom was 38 when I graduated from high school. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, so they were young. And so, but anyway, I was fortunate I had them. But all I did was I would buy a case of beer every day and I'd drink it. And sometimes I'd get drunk and sometimes I wouldn't. And those neighbors would come over because I'd get thirsty and I needed to go out. And then I had a 16-year-old girl that moved in downstairs, and she was like, you know, an instant babysitter. And she helped me a lot, a lot. I will be forever grateful to her, because my life had just blown up and I didn't know what to do. and except drink. That's what I did. And I reconnected with some old friends. But one night I can remember thinking about, wait a minute, you know what? Yeah, I'm sorry, my timeline off, but I don't. My brain's a little tired. I apologize. Anyway, so one night I'm thinking, you know, I'm drinking, I'm laying in the bed, and I'm going, you know, it was just the wrong guy. So I still think it's not the alcohol. I still think human power is going to relieve me of alcoholism. It's going to make me better. And that's really a sad place to be, that human power is so big. It's destructive. And it's not, it's me. It's my alcoholism. It's the way it manifests itself. You know, that need to feel important, that need to feel loved, even though I was had loads of love in my home and with my family. When I'm in the throes of my alcoholism, I don't see any of that. My alcohol is such a separator. It separates me from me, you, God. I don't see the truth. I don't see anything that's real. I see what I want to see. And if I don't like what you're saying, I'll push you right out of my life. You don't want me to be happy. You don't need to be in my life. You don't want what's best for me. You don't want to be in my life. And so, anyway, I went to a bar, Cimarron Rose, which should be, it should say daycare now, and that's appropriate because it was a huge pickup city USA place. But I think I had on my forehead, come get me, I'll fall for any line, because I felt that bad about myself. I felt that bad that I was appreciative of anybody and, you know, showing attention. So I meet somebody and I think about how my thinking about this used before I got sober, you know, the whole soulmate thing. And meet people and tell them everything, every detail about your life, the good, the bad, the ugly, the everything. That's not necessary. You know, I learned that in sobriety. You don't need to do that. They don't need to know all that stuff. But I thought it was a great connector. I thought, ooh, and you know, and I met this guy and we commiserated. And I went out on relationships, not dates. I did not know how to go out on dates with people. I was like immediately together, like Keith Lewis says, two chicks without the dog. You know, you know, that was me. It's like, oh, you know, so I met him that night and the next 3.5 years went out on that relationship. Anyway, it turned out to be, and you know, and I thought he, oh my God, you know, because we both had been wronged and you know, connecting on that. You know, it's just us against the world, you know, all that stuff that we, it's crazy. But he introduced me to a world that I'd not been exposed to before, that the DEA doesn't look kindly on, and that's all I'm going to say. And so I, you know, everything went to a different level. And I'll sum it up and say the next 4 years, 4.5 years, I moved in with my parents 4 different times. I'll take you up right up to about the last 6 months. What happened during those prior is getting evicted from places, going through a lot of jobs, not paying my bills, throwing them in the trash, taking my kids to Toys R Us and tell them they can buy a $20 toy so I can feel better about me. It wasn't even about them thinking I'm a good mom. I just needed for 1 minute to feel like I was a good mom. I hated myself with a passion. I'm stealing from my family. I'm stealing from my brother. He's saving money in his room. He's 17. He won't even eat in the kitchen. Because it's so much chaos that I create in that house. You know, I'm stealing from my other brothers. I'm stealing from my parents, a checkbook, writing checks all over town. And I'm doing all, I turned in everything I hated, you know, and it's all because, you know, the alcoholism had a grip on me so bad. I wouldn't even look you in the eye when you talk to me because I didn't even know how to carry on conversations. At you know, that last 6 months, I got arrested twice and I got detectives saying, what's a girl like you doing? And I'm just like, only thing I could say was, I don't know, because I didn't. I was so void of a person. It had robbed so much. And it just, it, thank God for alcohol. It got me through it. And I managed it with other things as well. But I'm telling you, alcoholism through and through, I'm an alcoholic. And it was just a really tough time. And I was sad and scared that I was gonna have to drink the rest of my life or die. And I ended up, that relationship with that guy turned out to be even worse than the one with their dad. But yeah, and that's just, you know, another, you know, that's what happens when you feel bad about yourself and you're on that level, you're going to attract what you are. Sick attracts sick. I mean, that's just the way it is. You're going to attract sick, you know, and that's what happened. And so my parents are trying to help me out. And I'm that last 6 months, I did got arrested. I'm trying to think the way it all happened. You know, I can remember being in this job that this lady gave me a second chance. I guess she saw a really broken girl, you know, and she said, I've been in where you're at, you know, and she wanted to help me out. And I'm thinking, I'm not broken, you know. Of course, we that arrogance, that pride, because I just wasn't ready to say, I am broken. I'm dying. And I was dying. And I mean, I'm looking at people driving to work going, what does that feel like? Just me driving to work like a regular person. You know, I was terrified. I'd never feel like that. You know, I'm looking at my children sitting in my mom's kitchen. I'm thinking, I know I love them, but I don't even feel good feelings anymore. And that scared me because I love those kids like nobody's business. I felt nothing, zero. And so I'm, you know, crying a lot and going to the store and coming back 3 days later, you know, borrowing money. Finally, my parents, God bless. I mean, my brothers are like, why can't you stop? My dad's crying. And finally, my mom's like, you know, we love you, but you're going to have to leave. And that was the best thing they could have done. You know, if you enable me, I'm not going to see the truth. You know, I'm not. And so they, mom said, you know, so I went to my friend, you know, of course, drama queen. I packed everything up and, you know, that those times, and I'd have them very briefly, but like a millimeter of a second that would go through you, like, I'm going to do something different. You know, just for a minute, or not even a minute, millimeter. But it was gone as quick as it came. And I couldn't grab it because alcoholism was bigger. You know, it was bigger. And it was my master for sure. And so, but I'm like, I'm going to go do something. And well, if I knew something about solutions, wouldn't I be doing it? No, I went to my friends and drank. Now, after a week, my mom got word to me somehow. And a lot of that's a blur because I was just in a state of alcoholism, but a state of everything. And she said, come home, but you're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, and all I knew about AA was Days of Wine and Roses, those movies, you know, and things like that. I don't know anything about it. I didn't really hadn't even thought about it. Meanwhile, there's a lot happening during this time. She says that, and I went to my first meeting, and that's where I heard the music, the language of the heart. I didn't know that. That's where I heard people describing how I was feeling inside, and I didn't even know them. And that touched something in me. I was like, took my breath away. It's like, oh my God. I mean, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And then I thought, you know, alcoholism runs its mouth. Ah, that's just there. It's not gonna be like that somewhere else. Went to another one, saw the same thing. At work, these people are 12-stepping me, and I don't even realize it. They're telling me about their spouses and all went to St. John's Hospital and got sober. And I'm like, huh, wonder why they're telling me. You know, and they're, you know, so I'm like writing down the number. It's a big covert mission and going there secretly calling to St. John's and answering all the questions. And he's like, yeah, you need to be here. And I'm like, well, I mean, that surrender is not like, okay, I surrender. You know, it's like little by slowly. And so that's going on. I went home, you know, I was back and I went to the meetings. And I just telling you, I thought, I said, I'm going to die. I'm dying. And I don't think I can. And I thought I'd be dead by the time I was 30 years old. I really did. And got sober at 30. And so what happened, and I can remember at work, you know, looking in the mirror and seeing what I really looked like and not even recognizing myself. And I weighed like 100 pounds and I'm 5'6", and that's not pretty. That's not healthy looking. And I was just, again, the hate for myself and my family is just trying. And my children, you know, children are so resilient. They love you. They love you. And they're just beautiful people. And so what happened is April 11th, 1988, I woke up and something was different. Something was different. It's like I felt like I had this, I don't know, something was different. And I went into my job and I said, I'm dying. I need to take a leave of absence, and I don't care if I lose my job. And that's surrender. Then I called St. John's and they had a bed. I called my mom, and we were already living there. And she's like, you know, great. They're crying. They're so grateful. My brother that wouldn't eat in the kitchen drove me out there. Two reasons, I think. Get her out of the house because the chaos. I mean, I stole so much love and created so much fear in that house. I mean, my parents 3 in the morning getting phone calls, me screaming because of this crazy situation I was in with that guy, and the kids are there. And I mean, just the things, you know. I know it didn't just affect me. That ripple effect, that negative ripple effect. I mean, my alcoholism touched anybody I came in contact with. That could be the checkout person at 7-Eleven. Could be anybody, you know, by the way I act or what I do. You know, I can remember I went to a bar before I got sober, and I remember sitting in there because I had stopped really going to bars, but I went in there by myself. I didn't want anybody around me. Anybody that was trying to call me out, I'd say, you don't love me. You're not my friend. And so I really had pushed everybody out of my life. And I wrote on a little piece of paper, get help. And I found that paper in a pocketbook after I'd been sober a few years. That was kind of cool. I still got it. But I still remember they're sitting there. So crazy that these little profound moments that we can remember, you know. But I called, you know, St. John's had the bed. My parents, you know, yeah, my brother's going to drive me out there. He got to keep my car. I think that was the biggest thing. He was just glad I can eat in the kitchen and I get to keep her car. They were trying to get him to fill out this packet of paper. He's like, what? You know, he gave me $10 and ran for the hills. And good for him. But I had a great experience, 28 days. And the truth is, I needed to get off the merry-go-round. I needed to go somewhere and physically get sober. I gained 15 pounds in treatment. I can remember begging God that night, April 11th, laying in bed, just going, all right, this is it. Please let this be it. Please. Because I never didn't believe in God. I mean, it was in my head, but I mean, it's not the way it is now. But I knew there was something bigger than me, but I didn't think I deserved it because I'd been living a life that wasn't deserving. And begging, saying, if this is it, let this be it. Please let this be it. And it is April 12th, 1988. I woke up the next morning and that's my sobriety date. And I was marveling. I can remember marveling at people, especially when they took us out to meetings. I was just marveling, looking at people with, you know, talking about their alcoholism and just being dressed. And Sunday morning serenity. I don't know if any of y'all ever went up there. There was like a 400 people meeting on Sunday morning and they took us there and just dressed to the nines and just happy and laughing. And I just fell in love. And I'm like, and I can remember in treatment, they'd say, 1 out of 10 of y'all gonna make it. And I say, well, I'm making it. I don't know about y'all. Good luck, you know, because I'm like, this, I got a chance to live. It wasn't even about drinking, it was about living. I get to live. And my mom would bring the kids to see me and send me letters and all. And the kids were even looking at me different. And like I said, kids love their parents, you know, and it was just so great. They were 8, 7, and 5 when I got sober, and beautiful people, beautiful children. And I still remember how that felt. You know, people say, you know, ride that pink cloud as long as you can, because it's going to wear off. I ain't never gotten off that pink cloud. And I've been sober over 30, 36 and a half years. So, you know, my feet are planted on the ground where the work, 12-step work is. That's what I was always told. And that's what I do. But man, I'm grateful to be alive. I mean, I get to be alive and do everything I do. I get to do. I get to do it. You know, none of us have to, it's a get to. You know, there's a way out. And I was so grateful for that. So I you know, had a good experience there. And when I got in a lot, and big surprise, you know, I lost a job while I was in treatment. I had the felony hanging over my head and they pushed it aside till I was 14 months sober. And so when I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous, so it's a single mom with 3 children, 8, 7, and 5. And I had a holy resume. I had no credit because I didn't pay my bills. And but I was sober. Yeah, I was sober. And that had to be enough. And I tell people that, you know, it's got to be enough. You know, no credit, no job, but I'm sober, man. I am sober. And I had beautiful children. And I didn't lose my children. I mean, I know sometimes that happens and very fortunate. And I just, you know, will be for and that felony hanging over my head, those three things. I kept thinking there's a third thing. And so what happened is I got out and I came out of treatment and I started going to meetings every day and I'd make myself get 3 women's phone numbers. You know, nowadays we have sponsor trees and if you get a sponsor, you get this whole tree of people. You know, I mean, I know with me, you know, because we have a sponsor tree and gathering where we are, we did not all areas do, but we do. And but then it wasn't, you know, and so I just had to really go out and I think it was good, you know, we and it was no cell phones. I mean, answer machines came out the year I got sober. You know, and I thought that was the coolest thing, an answer machine and VCR. And so and so I can remember getting an answer machine and you know, like running home to see if the little light was blinking and somebody was calling me. They didn't want money. Anyway, so anyway, I can just remember how cool that was. But I made myself go to meetings every day. Well, I went to meetings every day and made myself get 3 women's phone numbers that I make myself call them and just say, hey, I'm practicing calling. Because as outgoing as I am, that had all been, that was gone from the alcoholism. I had to re, you know, get better from the inside out. And I learned about the fellowshipping. I got, you know, and I'd hear this, they're planning something and I'd go over there and help with it. But I remember asking someone and I'd say, you know, I'm gonna feel like you look, what do I gotta do? And they say, get a sponsor. And I did get a home group and I did and get a job in that home group. And I did. And I learned about making myself a part of the we. And they gave me a key to the church. And I forever will be grateful for that because I have been able to do that for people. And I know how special that feels when somebody says here, especially when you feel like we do when we first get sober. Nobody, I've been tearing up lives and hate myself, and you're trusting me. You gave me the key to the church. Wow. And so I also learned about being in a busy home group. I fell into a busy home group. I learned about fell at the meet before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting, learned all about just being a part of something. And I'm responsible for that. I learned that from the get-go from being in that busy home group, which I'll be forever grateful. I'd get there early, I set up the chairs, I'd make the coffee. I didn't drink coffee. Well, I was talking about that earlier today at my home group, about I'm a tea drinker. And so, but I drank coffee in treatment because I wanted to belong. And they gave you decaf, but I found out where the real coffee was. So I would make pots of real coffee and then tell the people that were my buddies to say, it's in that pot over there. Sneaking is so much fun. You know what I mean? Anyway, but I didn't even like coffee. I would drink it. And finally, one day I was like, why am I drinking this stuff? I still belong if I don't drink the coffee. But we'd go up to Aunt Sarah's and sit for hours and just the fellowshipping and just the learning about, getting involved. And I got a sponsor and, learned about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I say, what man of the hell I never thought I'd get out of. I can't, I really did. And the steps connected me to, I little did I know, because I'm going to talk about the steps in a general way because there's some other things I want to talk about. And little did I know that what the steps were going to do for me, transform me and connect me to the power that's within me so that I can help God's kids. Little did I know that 4 through 9 were going to tie up all those loose ends that I created before I got here. And that little did I know that 10 will take care of them every day if I practice it, and 11 will catch it if I don't get it in 10. So we have just got such a design for living here. And then 12, of course, the beauty of that, practicing at home, practicing everywhere I go, carrying a message, being able to help people, one drunk helping another. That's to me, boots on the ground, fire right front. That's my favorite place to be. And now much sober. A girl in my home group said, hey, Christy, I want to go carry the meat. I'm going to take a meeting to the Goochland prison. You want to go? I'm like, sure. Well, fell in love with corrections. I've been doing it ever since. It's my favorite service. And I just love going behind the walls and sitting with a bunch of women and having an AA meeting. And I've been very fortunate to go into a lot of facilities and be in a lot of situations and to do that. And it's just so important and cooler, the things that have happened as a result of that through the years. I was sitting in a Panera with the sponsee last year, and this girl walked over to me and she said, hey, do you remember me? And I was like, no. She said, I want to thank you for coming into Jessica County Jail and bringing the meeting. I've been sober a year. And you're just like, oh my God, just like, man, I remember I was corrections chair years ago, and we had a table at the Virginia area, and this guy's walking over to the table crying. I said, what's going on? He said, I just want to thank y'all for saving my life. And I'm like, that's the deal. That we don't even realize we're so uniquely qualified to help give, take, stick your hand out, say, come on. It doesn't have to be like that. There's a way out. We got something that works here in this book. It's beautiful. And so, but that first year of sobriety was really special. When I first got out of treatment, I'm living with my parents and I'm like, okay, I want to get a job and I want to get my own apartment with the kids. And I don't know why I feel dizzy for a minute. Hang on, I'm getting too riled up and excited. Hang on. It happens. I have a thing that can do that, so I just have to slow down. Anyway, what I love is I can be transparent with you and tell you what's going on. Anyway, so I've learned about not reporting into sponsors, but asking advice because I would say, nobody will give me a job. I'm running around over-explaining to people why they need to be hiring me. It's like, why don't let's talk about how to do that. Because remember, I had that felony outstanding on my record. I didn't get it resolved till I was 14 months sober. So at this time, this is early sobriety, earlier when I lived with my parents. So finally, I did find a job that believed in giving people second chances. And that morning that I went in there, I read a meditation that morning for the second interview. And it said, if it's meant to be, it'll happen. If it's not, it means God's got something else planned. And that's been a pearl for me. Sometimes it's just practice. Sometimes I don't know what he wants, but I want what he wants. That's something I do know. And sometimes it's just practice. But I went in and they hired me because they believe in giving people second chances because I was very honest about what was going on in my life. And so I stayed there about 5 years. But what's important about that is then I was able to get my own apartment. Then I wanted to do it without my parents co-sign. It was just super important to me to do that. And I found a late after running around over explaining again and then remembering what the my sponsor's like, just say you need somebody to give you a second chance. And I went in and told this girl, I said, I'm really trying to start my life over and just need somebody to give me a second chance. And she said, I've been there. She said, somebody just moved out. I've got an apartment. I'm gonna give you a chance. And so the special part about that is that I can remember walking through that apartment, pinching myself, going, wow, this is my place. And I was so grateful. And I knew why. It's because I do what I do here. But it's even more special is that I could carry that hope to the women behind the walls and let them know they can have it too. Because that's what we do is share those hope stories with them. And when I was carrying meetings into a jail, Dennis and I had gotten married and we were moving away for 2 years. I went to this jail to say goodbye to the ladies, and the lady said, hey, so-and-so sent us a letter and wanted to let you know she got her own place. That, we share the hope. Our stories are all hope. That's why, that reading we do is said, I must have this thing. I must have this thing. I know that. And the way I do it is by what I do here. But my first year of sobriety was very special. I mean, those kids, I got pushed guys out of my life. I wouldn't have guys in my life. When I got sober, I was like, no guys. I wouldn't even go out on a date with anybody the first few years. I'd say, if you want more in friendship, don't hang around with me. I focused on raising my children, building my life, and I fell in love with General Service. Richmond had the assemblies there a lot back then, like every other year. Even though I did a lot with intergroup because it was local and my children were young, I still would always go because I love a General Service, structure and the way and just how everything works. And so that I fell in love with it, and I still love it and been fortunate to be active at it for quite a while. But what happened was my children and I started rebuilding our life. And so I would, this job paid me $7 an hour, but they'd pay me on the weekend to come and make extra money and clean up, and I'd get the kids to help me. So, I'm showing them about rebuilding. And so the journey began, and it was just filled with lots of goodness and carrying the message home, and the kids going to meetings with me and meeting y'all because they didn't have babysitting meetings back then. And they sit there and they color, and they grew up, and I grew up in sobriety. And at 14 months sober, though, I will say I went to court for that felony. And the prosecutor told the judge they didn't want me to serve any time after I told him what I've been doing for 14 months. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous because I had made the best of my time. I was a girl that was broken and hopeless and dying and took a solution and grabbed the hands of you and followed you out of that hell and has continued to, and did that. And that's what they saw. And that's why it's so important that we have CPC, Cooperation Professional Community, that talks to the judges and the prosecutors and everything to understand about alcoholism, because a lot of crimes behind the walls are tied to alcoholism and other things. That was, really special. And little did I know that, I'd fall in love with corrections like I did anyway. And so what's happened through the years is my life has gotten better and better. I think when we suit up and show up, as Dennis will say, you suit up and you show up and you keep doing it, and you get promoted and you get this and you get that. And it's all just gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just results. So what's happened for me is I married Dennis Ellis. I met him in service, and we got married in 2001. And I've already told you, he had three kids, I got three kids, and now we have nine grandchildren and four dogs. And we've always had a lot of dogs and all that. But we have an AA household. We've been blessed to, really attend a lot of conferences and internationals and just do a lot of really fun things together. But most of all, live a life of giving, because we get to give, we get to do things like that. My life in Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't been perfect, and I don't want it to be. I used to think everything had to be perfect when I got sober. The yardsticks went away, and the imperfect is good. I've learned, and I don't want it to be anything but that. I want it to be what God wants it to be, and so I talked about, believing God in my head. Well, God has gone to my heart, and now he's gone back to my head. So what's gone to my heart comes out in my head, and it means, I've got a big God in my life. I enlarge my spiritual life a lot. I sponsor a lot of ladies. We have book studies, traditions, concepts. We do all that stuff. I've been blessed with, tour guides that have taught me that. I believe that, again, that we take turns around here. I think that he just says, hey, come, God says, come here. And I say, okay. And that's where I land. And that's what's happened for me in my journey. I fell into a nonprofit career in 1995. I only have a few minutes. So I, it was really cool the way, it happened. And what I learned from that was, that, walk through the door when an opportunity presents itself, because, I don't know about you, but I'm good at telling you why I don't deserve that. And so I learned about walk through the door And for him and for me, and if I, again, if it's practice, it'll be practice. If it's not, it's where God wants me to be. And because I walked through that door and was given a chance by people, because remember, I'm the girl with the felony on her record and no college education. I landed into a 30-year career helping people, working with the homeless, working with ex-offenders, working with people experiencing poverty. And see, when I was 13 years old, remember I said, I'm gonna save the world. I want to help others person. Well, God, I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous brings us back to what we're supposed to be doing, you know, and we learn it here. And if I ever forget that, I'm in trouble. I know why I have this gift. I know my life is the way it is because of the actions that I've taken here and I do take here for Alcoholics Anonymous and helping his children. Priority. I've been given a primary purpose. I've been given a responsibility. I get, you know, I've been given the opportunity to live. I've been given, you know, and real quickly, I'd like to talk about my children. My daughter, I love my daughter like nobody's business. We've been close as anything. All her life, she'd say, "Mom, I want to be just like you." Painfully, I have to say, you know, a year ago, she decided she didn't want to talk to me anymore. That has been devastating. But I'll call it, I don't know why, but I've learned to let people have their own experience. And I'm grateful for the, you know, the program that, I mean, super close. I don't know why. And God re has revealed other people going through the same thing. So I'm like, okay. You know, my son Justin, he was 7 when I got sober. Brooke was 8. Justin was married and then got divorced. And he has my grand the grandchildren, Eli and Poppy, that I'm particularly close to. I love them all, but I'm particularly close to these two. And he was had a house he had to rent. And I've always taught them that things happen. You know, you got to, what, you know, the right people will come when it's time. And he was trying to rent it. He didn't find the right people. And he called me. He said, "Mom, I don't know." You know, he said, "You always tell me the right people are going to come." I said, "They are, Justin. Just hang tight." And they believe me. When these things, they came so much, and I lived it in my household enough that they're living it. And I see that. And I know you've got children that do the same. And we see this in our children. It's beautiful. He called me one day. He said, "Hey, Mom." He said, I found my lady. It's a single mom with three kids. Little did I know that little 7-year-old years later would be able to give somebody a chance like somebody gave his mama that many years later. Beautiful. I'm just, and he, we both just started, we got a little teary-eyed. We were like, he was like, "Oh my God." I said, "I know, it's beautiful, man, to be able to do that." And then my youngest son, Jared, biggest heart, and he's so healthy about, he's the only one not married. And he's like, he had this girl that really liked him a lot. And he's like, "But I don't feel the same way, Mom. It's not right." And I'm like, "Where did you, wow, that healthy thinking." Anyway, grateful for it. But anyway, I want to share, they're amazing individuals because of you, and I thank you. My other children is what I call them, my other son and daughters, amazing people, all 6 of them, beautiful children. My dad died suddenly 10 years ago, and it was heartbreaking. My dad cried at the first Thanksgiving saying the prayer. He was so grateful that I was sober. I became super close to my dad. My dad used to say thank you when I told him I loved him. I thought that was kind of weird. I was like, "Hey, Dad, I love you. Thank you." I'm like, "What?" And so, but and then when I got sober, I'm like, you know, and it was a generational thing, you know. And then, you know, and I'm like the hugger and I'm all over it, you know, me. I'm like, I'm gonna, you know, and by the right before he died, last thing he said was, "I love you," before he went into, guess, a coma. But he, we became very close, and it was really special. And I remember he was, they had him on all the machines, and we think he might have already been gone. But I can remember standing there, and you know, I'm thinking, I need to say something. I need to say something. And then it's like God said, "No, you don't. He already knew. You spent your entire sobriety showing him the gratitude for everything he did." Because he would tell you, he'd say, "See that girl over there? I can always count on her. That's my daughter." And that's who I've become in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've become someone that people can count on, someone they can trust, someone that they know I'm gonna tell them the truth. Someone that, look, they ask me something, I'll say, "How can I help? What can I do for you?" And it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've become, I don't hate myself. I love myself. When someone tells me a good thing about me, I've learned that emotional sobriety is about dependence on God, I believe, but it's also about when someone tells you something nice about yourself, you know it's true, and that's in your heart, not your head. So I do thank you for today. I'm sorry I got a little scattered if I was, but it's always a pleasure to talk about something that saved my life and that I get to live every moment of every day helping God's kids. I don't know what the, well, I got a new adventure getting ready to start because God has put me in another position to do something, but I know I won't be doing it alone. I'll be doing it with a village, And it's just my turn. So thanks.